recording for week two. I'll say it because it's probably pretty obvious from my voice. Anyway, for those who are joining, yes, I have joined the COVID club. It's the way it goes, but Tylenol is good, and that's just the way it goes. So I wanted to give the class. I did not want to cancel it. It'll make me feel better to have this conversation, and if at some point I feel like it's just not good, then I'll stop. You know, that's the way it goes. Last week we introduced Agnon, and you know, one thing that I didn't mention last week was I talked about how his writing is often surreal, right? It seems to leave reality at some point, and we're going to see that in this story. What I didn't mention was that people used to ask Agnon if he had read Kafka, if Kafka was an influence, and he denied it outright. He said, absolutely not, I never read it. That I knew. But this week I came across a book about Kafka, which talks about Kafka's admiration for Agnon. Kafka apparently reached out to Agnon. I thought that was really interesting. But that's just a side note. We read part of the story last week. In the beginning of the story, we met an old man who is suffering terribly. He's descended from wealthy wine merchants, but circumstances which are not disclosed in the story made him a vinegar maker instead. It's obviously less lucrative, and also it's bad for a person in terms of the fumes from the vinegar. He loses his wife. He loses his children. His home is falling apart. He's suffering. Even his connection to God gives him no joy. And we noted some notes in the text which highlight the suffering that he is undergoing and the messianic longing for salvation. So we had the verse from Daniel, which is hinted at in the text. We had a verse from Psalms, which is hinted at in the text. And then we moved on to see what his longing is. His longing is not a religious longing for a Messiah as much as it is love for the land of Israel. God is still a part of it, but it's about wanting to make Aliyah, wanting to move to Israel. He actually wants to be buried there, which is a very interesting thing because, you know, the sages actually have a line in the Talmud in which they say that one should live in Israel and not simply be buried in Israel. When they bring a body to Israel for burial, they're bringing impurity to the land. It will be better for people to be there while they are alive. Certainly that's our hope also. We would like that. Yes, Susan.
Was Agnon himself religious?
So Agnon himself was a religious man in the beginning of his life, was a religious man for the last 50 years of his life. There's some debate as to what happened in his period in Germany, and whether he left things, or even in his first round in Israel. I mentioned last time that he used to go to the classes of Rav Kook. Some actually have argued, something that's very interesting, that his religion at that stage was part of his act. In other words, he's a very dramatic person. I gave a class at Adath Israel a few years ago about Agnon and Lag BaOmer, and how he talked about how Lag BaOmer, which is an important day on the Jewish calendar for rejuvenation and for growth, was also the day when a whole bunch of things happened for him, when he moved to Israel, when a certain book of his came out, when a translation of his work came out, when he got married. Like, Agnon was a very dramatic person, so some critics have argued that that was actually, you know, his persona, so to speak. However, his daughter says, absolutely not. In interviews, she has said she remembers him praying in the morning, wearing talis and tefillin at home with no one to see him. You know, he was a religious person. What is without doubt is that not only was he a religious person, but he was absolutely brilliant in terms of what he drew on in rabbinic literature. Biblical literature, we noted last time, one verse from Daniel, another verse from Psalms. We're going to see rabbinic literature that he draws on as well. He's got it all up in his head and he's putting it into the writing. Less so in this story than in some of his other stories, but it's really mind-blowing. By the way, I didn't mention this last week, but in between last class and this class, I reached out to Shoshana Aegis. Shoshana has run an Agnon group in Toronto for decades. She and her husband, Olav Shalom, ran it. Her husband passed away, I think about a year and a half ago. But pre-COVID, they met quite a few times a year. Then during COVID, they've met sometimes on Zoom, and they would learn stories.
Arnold.
I'm sorry, Diane?
It was Arnold.
It was,
husband.
Yes. Yeah. So.
The story, I'm sorry to interrupt, but the story is very Job-like.
Yes, it is very Job-like. I'm going to come back to that. You are 100% correct. I just wanted to mention, I reached out to Shoshana to ask her if the group is open to new people. So if anybody is interested, email me and I'll give you her contact information. And you could find out more about Agnon that way. But moving on within the story, the hero of the story starves himself, fasting Monday, Thursday, in order to travel to Israel. We talked about the symbolism of the Monday, Thursday fasts in religion, in and how the hero of the story co-opts that for his desire to make Aliyah, to move to Israel. He keeps his money that he's saving up in a public charity box held with a statue of Yeshu by the road. So we talked about various elements within the text that show how his religious goal is making Aliyah. It's not all the other mitzvot, it's moving to Israel. But this desire is actually harmful for him. We said it's stabbed into his heart. And Agnon used a verse which describes the spears that are stabbed into David's son Avshalom, Absalom, when he is killed. Then we moved on in the story, and that's where we got up to, where we talked about the great joy that the hero feels from his drive to move to Israel, and how he's marking his contribution of funds every week via notches on his vinegar container. He's dancing at night with the container in which he holds the vinegar, and and he's forever thinking about thoughts of Aliyah. That's what he wants. And even religious services, he's distracted from that. He's also not taking care of his home. He's not paying his taxes. It's just about this one goal. And now we're going to go back into the translation. We're up to, in the translation, the part where it says, "And thus several years passed." I'm not going to share screen with it this time. It's challenging enough for me to do this, you know, while sick. But I put in the link in the chat, both the link for you to download the translation and the link for the source sheet. So you should be able to get it from there. In the event that you can't, just listen to me read it aloud, and that should be okay. If you're looking at the translation, we're on page 193, and we are up to the beginning of the paragraph where it says, "And thus several years passed." Okay, people see it? Okay. All right. "And thus several years passed," with him trying to raise these funds to be able to move to Israel. "The old man, out of love for his work, went around the town with his vinegar, after which he would apportion his earnings, one half for his immediate requirements and one half for his traveling expenses," right? We talked about that last time, how he's like the sage Hillel, who divides up his income into half for support of the family and half to be able to study Torah by paying the entrance fee for the study hall. But now, you notice, he loves his work. Beforehand, he did not love his work at all. Now, because the work is going to enable him to get to Israel, suddenly he loves his work. And continuing there. "Then he would make more vinegar to take around the town, apportioning his earnings, one half for his sustenance, one half of the charity box." You see how it's repeating it, because it's important, this image. "So is the nature of simple people, that notwithstanding the passage of years, they do not change their ways." He's going to keep on doing what he's doing. "And thus several years passed. The inner walls of his house began to peel. The roof began to leak. Cracks appeared in the walls. And when it rained, he was soaked to the skin, even when he was under the covers." And now, this translation, I think, is incorrect, but it's roughly accurate. "And the way taxes and rates were going up," is what it says in the English. If anyone is looking at the Hebrew for it, you will know that it's not quite precise, but looking back to it is beyond what I can do today. But it's not quite precise, but it's good enough as a translation. I think the original Hebrew was that he wasn't paying his taxes. "If he were to remain, either the state would take over his house, or his house would be his grave. The vinegar maker would lie on his bed at night, listen to the sound of the plaster crumbling from the walls, bit by bit snapping off and falling away, almost without being heard due to the moisture. But the old man's heart quavered like a bell, out of joy at God's mercy in keeping him alive and not letting him perish abroad. He's ecstatic that he is going to be able to make it. Everyone clear on what we've read so far? Yes, Rosalind.
In an Eastern European shtetl at some time in the far past. But what is all this vinegar? Like, who uses so much vinegar? Why?
Well, he's selling it. He's selling it in the community. I see what you're asking.
But for what? Like, who uses so much vinegar?
Right. Okay. It's a good question. I suspect it's about pre-refrigeration needing to pickle things. It is an interesting question because of the way that he sells it. He makes vinegar all week, and then he sells it on Friday. That would seem to me to be the wrong day to be selling it, right? That's right. When, you know, people need their food for tomorrow, not to be preserved down the line. I'm not quite clear on that. To me, the vinegar is more a device to talk about the man who is taking good fruit and turning it to vinegar. You know,
I'm guessing
hang on one second. I hear someone on the phone, but just one second. I think it's much more about him than it is about the business.
I'm just going to clarify. Vinegar is used for cleaning. That's Black Friday.
You think so? Maybe.
I think it's a metaphor actually for the bitterness of his life.
Yeah.
The fact that he was rich once and they dealt in wine, which, I mean, wine is the luxury. It's a...
Yeah.
You use it to sanctify ceremonies. Certainly in Judaism, you use it for a good meal. But I think it's to show how his life has devolved into hardship and bitterness.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. I also would note the word in Hebrew for vinegar is chometz, which is close to and etymologically part of the word for sour in Hebrew, which is chamutz. His existence is sour. You made the comment before about Job. I'm coming back to Job. I'm not ready for it yet, but we're going to come back to Job. So let's see where this goes. Unless there were other comments first on where we are. Okay. So let's go. Let's keep on reading here. There's so much going on that I want to call your attention to, but we need to cover some text first. So we're on 194, towards the top, where the paragraph breaks. At cockcrow, the old man would wash his hands and eyes. Right, remember, he got up at midnight to dance. We talked about that. Now he's getting up at the crow of... Actually, excuse me. My mistake. The cockcrow is midnight. It's the idea of the rooster crowing at midnight. I taught this story once before, and I did research on the rooster crowing at midnight. It's a fascinating theme. I didn't bring it this time because I felt it would be a distraction. But that's the idea. The rooster is crowing at midnight. So the old man would wash his hands and eyes, light the candle, and sit by the front door and wrap himself up as one who mourns and bewails the exile. And I talked about that last time, how there's a religious practice of rising at midnight to cry for the destruction of the temple. But that's not what he does. He wraps himself up like an atalas, as though that's what he's going to do. But as soon as he sees his can and how many scratches there are on it, he recalls immediately the money he had put into the charity box for his traveling expenses. He would pick up the can and drum on it with his fingers, songs and praises. And then, placing one hand on his hip and raising one shoulder, he would count how many scratches there were on the can, 2, 3, 40, 50, 100, dancing for joy. And then you get a very strange image. This is one of those images where when you see it in Agnon, you know something's going on. Not like those who dance over their heads, and not like those who, if they are put in one corner, are to be found in another, but like those who dance around their shoulders, moving their shoulders to and fro. Lest you think this is unclear because it's a translation, no, this is actually a fairly strong translation of the Hebrew. And so he would hop about until summoned by the beadle, the shamash, to services. I'm pausing there for a second. Take a look, please, at the source sheet. What in the world is this business of dancing around his shoulders? What's that about? So, in source number one, I brought you something from the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, in which he talks about dance as elevation. For those who are not aware, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe lived at the end of the 18th century. Rabbi Schneur Zalman of Liadi. There were seven Lubavitcher Rebbes. He was a brilliant authority in Jewish law. He wrote a code of Jewish law that is still in use today. And he also obviously was a Hasidic leader. And look at what he has to say here about dance as a way to elevate oneself. He says, this is the meaning of dancing, that the groom and bride dance opposite each other. First, they are close together, and then they become distanced, apart in space, and the bride turns her face, etc. And then they draw near, actually close. He says, when a Jew is dancing, it's like a bride and groom. We are dancing, getting closer to God, and then being distanced from God. For through the duration of the diaspora, until the Redeemer comes speedily in our days, it is above the groom and bride above. In other words, God and the Jewish people, the celestial groom and bride, are dancing, drawing close, and then distancing themselves from each other. So he talks about there the idea of dance as something of elevation. Agnon, remember I said last week, it's his mother's side, that comes from Hasidim. He would have been familiar with this, but he's also blending in something else. Take a look at source number 2, a passage from the Talmud about when Rabbi Akiva prayed. Such was the practice of Rabbi Akiva. When he prayed communally, he abbreviated and ascended, meaning he would daven quickly, he'd pray quickly. He didn't want to take a long time, lest he strain the community, because everybody's waiting for him. When he prayed privately, one would leave him in one corner and find him in a different corner. Why so much? Why, how did he end up in the different corner? From the bendings and bowings. He put his energy into what he was doing when he prayed. He would start in one corner, and he would end up in a different corner. And now you look at Agnon, at the phrase that we just read, where he says, where was it? Not like those who, if they are put in one corner, are to be found in another. He is referring directly to Rabbi Akiva. What is his point? You know, what is this exactly all about? So to me, it's focusing on the fact that he has this desire to go to Israel as a religious desire. However, he's not leaping up to heaven. Do you notice the description of his dancing? Right? He gives you the position in which he's dancing. He's got his shoulder up and he's counting the spots on the marks on the can, but not like those who dance over their heads, not like those who dance to heaven. It's not about God. It's about his desire to journey to Israel. That's what this is really about for him. Do you follow? You hear what I'm saying? It's not Rabbi Akiva. It's not this religious elevation. Going back into the text, upon hearing the beetle's voice, we're in the middle of page 194, I think someone just joined, so I'm going to repost the link. Upon hearing the beetle's voice calling to services, he would say to himself softly, I will get up and go to prayers, abashed at being so happy in this world. He feels bad about being so happy. Why? Take a look on your source sheet, please. It's source number 3. Talmud says, one may not fill his mouth with laughter in this world, because Psalms says, then in the future, our mouth will be filled with laughter and our tongue with song. When is this going to be? As the verse in Psalms continues, when the nations will say, God has performed great deeds for them, for the Jewish people. So he says, I know that what I'm doing is really wrong. I shouldn't be so happy in this world. My happiness is not religious. My happiness is my personal satisfaction, and he feels bad about it. So what does he do? Back in the text. And then he would get on his feet and take with him his talit and tefillin. How tattered was his talit, virtually disintegrating with tears or tears, actually. Actually, it's tears, not tears. Sorry, I'm fairly sure, but I'm going to double check that in the original. But I believe it's tears, not tears. Hold on 1 second. It is Dema'ot. It is tears. Okay, thank you. For some reason, I'm not finding it so easily, but it's, yeah. Okay, so it is tears. Thank you. That's good to know. So, going back into the text. Thank God he is going to Jerusalem, where one is buried without a talit. Right? There are different practices religiously about whether one wears a talis, in, you know, whether that's one of the shrouds or not. They're not going to bury me in a talis, it's okay. When prayers were over, and unless it was a fast day, he would dip a slice of bread into a glass of weak brew and lick the dust with his tongue so as not to be tempted to indulge in meat and wine. Then would he get down to making vinegar. And here we go. 5 days a week, he made vinegar. On Fridays, he would fill up the can and make his rounds about town. Upon his return, he would apportion the money he had made, one half for his immediate requirements, there it is again, the other for his traveling expenses, and when no one was looking, he would thrust his finger through the cobwebs that had gathered during the week around the slit in the charity box, which was clasped between the hands of that man, and would put the coins into the box. He was a simple man and knew not the purpose for which the box served. Each time he put coins in the box, he would add another scratch on the can for a sign. And thus, several years passed. His body became bent like a ram's horn, and he groaned from the heart. This is an example of Agnon's wit here. What is a ram's horn called in Hebrew?
Shofar.
A shofar, precisely. In Talmudic Hebrew, the box that they use as a tzedakah box, as a collection box in the temple, is called a shofar. So it's not that he's bent like a ram's horn, although that is clearly part of the image, but he's bent like a traditional charity box. I find that very interesting. But in any case, the vinegar ate away half of his lungs. He breathed with difficulty. Most of the time he suffered, there was hardly enough left of him to fill his clothes. But each Friday afternoon, he would add another scratch to the can, although there was barely room for one more. Now he was already saying that it was high time to go up to the land of Israel, for he said, last Friday afternoon, when I put my money in the can, I could see the coins peeping out of the box. But as long as the can is whole, it is hard to retire. He can't bring himself to stop until the container breaks. Pausing. Questions, comments? Rose.
I just wanted to say one thing, and I know that I noted it last time. They keep re-emphasizing that he was a simple man.
Yep.
He was a simple man.
Yep.
And I'm wondering if he's trying to introduce a theme that everybody's the same, or not really, because they keep saying it. In other words, everybody's equal. Freedom, mm-hmm. God makes everybody equal at the end. But I don't know, but I noticed it last time, and I noticed it this time.
You are correct. And that is definitely part of where we're going with this. If you flip the page, you'll see a section called Ode to the Simple Jew. And yes, we're going to be talking about that. You are definitely correct. Susan, you were going to say?
The whole story is so upsetting and depressing.
Mm.
I mean, it may be some more point of view. I don't see it. I just see this poor, unfortunate man who lost the whole family. Compare that to the Holocaust, I don't know, but then he, a joke, but then he goes, his life is just so sad, he never looks into anything.
Right.
He never changes, he never improves himself, he never, and all these horrible things befall him, and it's like, I get the feeling almost Agnon's blaming him indirectly for not.
So I don't think Agnon is blaming him. I think that's harsh. I think he is describing him with warts and all. One note, just you mentioned the Holocaust. Keep in mind, this is written pre-Holocaust. This is first written in the 1920s, the early 20s. So that wouldn't be it. But yes, it's a tremendous, tremendously sad story for sure. Vanessa and then Janine. Mm.
I think that there must be some significance in just the two body parts that
yeah.
I mentioned.
Right, so that's actually a hint at a ritual. The idea that when one rises in the morning, they're supposed to first wash their hands, and then with the remainder of the water that's on their hands, they rub their eyes. And that's what Agnon is referring to here. But what he's saying, I think, with that, which you picked up on well, what he's saying with that is he, the old man, is engaged in rituals we would consider religious rituals, but only built around his desire to move to Israel. It's not about anything else within the religion.
So the religiosity of Agnon is being shown here once more with this ritual of walking the hand.
Right. He's filling in all sorts of allusions to religious ritual. Absolutely. Janine.
I wonder if that line jumped out at me, that as long as the jug was whole, it was hard to separate himself. It's almost a critique of us, of the way we live our lives.
You got it. 100%. 100%. I'm going to be coming back to this, in general, this story and its message about Zionism, because that is a key part of this story that we'll have to discuss. It is very much a part of this. And again, I mentioned last week, it's originally published in the 20s. It's republished in the 50s. But in the 20s, it's in the context, if I remember correctly, of a book about life in Poland. And then in the 50s, it's in the context of a book about Israel. And it's seen as reflecting both of those. You know, there are pieces to each, but we'll talk about it. You are definitely picking up on something here. So let's go back to the story. Oh, Etty, sorry, I missed you.
My question is this box that he's putting the money in.
Yeah.
It's a public box. Do other people not put money in that box? So it's not all his money.
Did you notice that when he goes to do it, he has to brush the cobwebs aside? He's the only one using the box. That's part of the problem. But now, the part that we're up to is where it's going to get interesting in that regard. Claudette.
The box and the money. Is Agnon saying that the Jewish people in that society was putting their trust in the hands of the Gentiles?
You bet. Very, very much a part of this story. I mentioned last week the Balfour Declaration. We're going to be coming back to that. You bet. Absolutely 100%. Okay, let's go through more of the story. We are now in the middle of the page, page 195. One day, while the old man was pouring off vinegar, the can burst. Whether he sold any more vinegar, I never knew, right? I don't live at this time. I am recording what happened. But I heard that he went to the image of that man and took a stone to break open the charity box and take out his money. I also heard that on the same day, Roman priests came to open the charity box and found him standing over the charity box with the stone in his hand. They seized him and put him in prison. No sooner had they seized him and put him in prison than the whole town was seething like hell. Gehinnom. Some said, the world is going to the dogs, there is no more faith, right? Look at this terrible person, he's stealing from the charity box. Others said, the tradesman is but a product of his trade. For as vinegar is none other than fermented wine, so has this old man shown himself to be wicked. The former and the latter, all ashamed, sighed ruefully at such sacrilege, saying, and this is the worst translation in the entire story, oh, what an unworthy son born of a worthy father. I can't believe they did that. What is, my Hebrew speakers, when you have it in front of you, what do you think is the original Hebrew? We referenced it last week. Bingo! Hoy chometz ben yayin. Whoa, vinegar son of wine. That is a very important image. Take a look, please, at source number 5. They completely lost the reference. It's a passage in the Talmud. I gave you first the Hebrew quote from the story. Kovshim pneihem bakarka. Everybody buried their faces in the ground. They're ashamed of what this Jew has done. Right? It's going to get them in trouble with the church. Umis anchim al chilul Hashem. They were moaning, groaning over the desecration of God's name. The Omrim, and they said, Hoy chometz ben yayin, woe, this vinegar son of wine. which of course he is. He's a vinegar maker whose ancestors made wine. But look at the story in the Talmud where this comes from. Rabbi Elazar, the son of Rabbi Shimon, advised a government police officer regarding how to catch a thief. I skipped his advice, but basically he said, go to the bars, go to the taverns in the morning and see who's there and whether they look tired, like they were up during the night. And there are various excuses for why they might have been up during the night, and if none of those excuses apply, then clearly they're a criminal. So apparently this worked, did nicely. Word of this was brought to the government, and they said, let the reader of the scroll be the one to carry it out. Right? He's the one who gave the advice. Let him, you know, hire him. Let him be a policeman. They brought Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Shimon, and he caught thieves. That's what he did. Rabbi Yoshua ben Karcha sent to him. Rabbi Yoshua ben Karcha might have been Rabbi Akiva's son. That's a side point. He sent a message to Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Shimon. He says, vinegar, son of wine. There's the line. How long will you pass the nation of our God to be murdered? You're catching Jewish thieves. You're turning them over to the government. And the point, as is discussed in rabbinic commentary on this passage, is that Jewish law says if someone is a thief, so there are certain punishments for him. But it doesn't match what the Romans are going to do. By turning him over to the Romans, they're going to punish these people far more harshly than Jewish law warrants. That's a terrible thing to do. Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Shimon, responded, I am eliminating thorns from the vineyard. These are bad people. Let the Romans have them. To which Rabbi Yoshua ben Karcha replied, let the owner of the vineyard come and eliminate his own thorns. You don't need to turn them over to the Romans. Let God worry about that. That's the dialogue. Between them, there is more to the story, you know, that follows this this passage. But there's a connection here. Agnon is borrowing the Talmudic phrase, not by accident. Nothing Agnon does is by accident. What is he doing? He's playing up the injustice in this story. How this guy is innocent. He didn't know any better, but it's all his money. And what we're saying is that Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Shimon, in this story, is accused of being unjust, even though he is the one who is just in his perception of events. I'm just catching thieves. And yet he's being criticized as vinegar, son of wine. Your father was great. Your father was Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. He was fantastic. You're terrible. You're vinegar, son of wine. Just like this old man is being accused of being vinegar, son of wine. You follow? That's what Agnon is drawing on. He's highlighting the injustice. And again, I'm so annoyed that they didn't translate it properly. But all right, we go further. The old man sat in jail, chained in irons. We're now about 10 lines up from the bottom on page 195. The old man sat in jail, chained in irons, but his wrists were thin, and the irons did not press on them. When God brings an affliction upon a man, God relieves the bitterness so that he might cope with the suffering. And yes, that's a rabbinic idea as well. The old man sat in jail and shook his chains. Hordes of bugs and the like went scurrying. He was afraid to lie on the floor. He put his head between his knees like the early mystics until he was brought before the judge. So we're going to need to talk about that. Let me just pause there for a second. I thought I was pausing before that. I went a little bit too far. The part that I'm looking for, hang on. No, you know what? It's okay. I'm going to talk about this business of his position, sitting with his head between his knees like the early mystics, and then I'm going to go with something else after that. I made a mistake in my notes. It's fine. So this pose that Agnon refers to here is indeed a mystical pose. There's a body of Midrash called Heichalot, which describes the palaces up in the heavens, and it refers to this as the mode of the mystics, going all the way back to the time of Rav Hai Gaon. You're talking about the 9th century, I think, Common Era. Take a look at source number 8. Excuse me. Take a look at source number 8. It says, and perhaps you know that many of the scholars thought that one who is proper in many of the identified and clarified traits when he wishes to look upon the Merkava, God's throne, and to gaze into the heichalot, the palaces of the celestial malachim, the angels, there are ways. Fasting on particular days, placing his head between his knees, and chanting to the ground many songs and praises which are clarified. This is a 9th century text, but it's what Agnon is clearly familiar with. He, you know, it's to the letter, this this description. Also, the piece about his head between his knees is really, really important. Take a look, please, at, excuse me, take a look, please, at source number 7. This is from the book of Melachim, the book of Kings. It is a story in which Eliyahu, Elijah the prophet, appeals to God. The text that I'm commenting on in the story is the text where it said he put his head between his knees. As I brought you in source number 7, he niach rosho bein birkav. He put his head between his knees. Now take a look at source number 7, where I translate the verse from the book of Kings. And Ahab ascended and ate and drank, and Elijah ascended to the top of Carmel, and he lowered himself to the ground, and he placed his face between his knees. He is praying like the prayer of Elijah. That's what we're seeing here. It's when Elijah prays to bring rain. Professor Roman Katzman wrote about this story, and he argued that the idea here is to portray the old man as a mystical servant of God. That's what we're going for here, which obviously fits what we saw in source number 8. Also, if you flip the page and look at source number 9, look at the following story. And further, the text says, once Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa went to study with Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan's son was ill. He said, my son Chanina, pray for mercy for him and he will live. So he, Rabbi Chanina, placed his head between his knees, asked for mercy, and he lived. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said, had ben Zakkai pressed his head between his knees all day long, they would not have paid attention to him. Right? God would not have listened if I put my head between my knees. Why is it that God doesn't listen to my prayers? He only listens to Rabbi Chanina. His wife said to him, is Chanina greater than you? Is that what you're telling me? He replied, no, but he's like a regular servant before the king, and I'm like a noble visiting before the king. The king is more interested in his regular servant. I bring the story just to show that this is a position in which one petitions God. One more source, and then I'm going to bring this together. Take a look at source number 10, the story of Elazar ben Dordaya. Without going into the entire story, he was a man who was guilty of a lot of sin. And then he decided, when he heard someone tell him, there's no hope for you, you can never repent, he said, no, I'm going to change. And he says, first he appeals to all these different natural entities. He appeals to the mountains, pray for me, the river, pray for me, and so on. But then he realizes, no, I have to pray for myself. Elazar, the son of Dordaya, said, it depends only on me. He placed his head between his knees and cried out in tears until his soul left him, and a small voice emerged saying, Rabbi Elazar ben Dordaya is prepared for life in the next world. His prayer is accepted. He's even called rabbi, despite the fact that his life was not worthy. What's my point here? What am I trying to show you? At the end of his life, because now we are getting towards the end of this man's life, we get to the stage of his reunion with God as he makes Aliyah, as he actually goes to Israel. He would never have been identified as a mystic in the beginning of this story. He would never have been identified with somebody who was pleading with God in the beginning of this story. He performed actions which looked like religious rituals, but God was not a part of them. But now as we get towards him making his trip to Israel, trying to cash in on his deposits so that he can journey there, now he has a relationship with God. That's what I'm trying to show you here. You follow? That's the idea. Yes, Claudette.
Is Agnon throwing in the middle of the story all these mystic attitudes just take us to the conclusion of how he got to Israel at that and it's not about Christianity at the end.
So there will be a Christian piece to this. We're not there yet. But it's true that he has multiple themes. The Zionism theme stands on one way, the Christian theme is another one. There's the Job theme, which we haven't gotten to yet, but we're going to in source number 12. Like, there's a lot going on in these stories. Agnon always has many different games at once, so to speak.
Rabbi?
Yes?
On your third point, I have to argue that Hasidim, as my view, decided this to be happy in this world. You don't have to suffer in this world. You don't have to put yourself in a situation that you're in sorrow.
So the answer is yes and no. It's true that the reputation of Hasidim is greater happiness, enjoy the physicality of this world and use it to drive your spiritual connection to God. There is such a concept, but the reality of Hasidic thought is more complicated than that, because the Hasidim, some of them, and I you can't really generalize to all Hasidic groups. The Hasidic groups really do have their own identities. Gerer is different from Lubavitch, which is different from Satmar, you know, and so on. But there are groups of Hasidim that excelled in fasting. Like I would not, I didn't tackle that as one of the themes in the story to really pursue. It is a good question. It's not as straightforward as that. Excuse me. So, let's see what happens with this old man. Look at this. The can broke. I'm going to come back to the can breaking. We've got stuff to talk about with that. The Roman priests catch him trying to withdraw his deposits. People are very embarrassed and upset. He's in chains in the jail. The judge asked him, we're at the bottom of page 195, do you admit that you were about to open the charity box? The old man replied, I was about to open the box because the money. Before he could finish what he was saying, the judge said to him reproachfully, does the accused admit that he wanted to open the box? The old man wanted to explain to him that whatever he had done lawfully, since the money in the box was his. A man cannot be guilty of stealing his own money. And that actually draws on a Talmudic quote, which I brought you in source number 6, where it says, Ein Adam Nitpas Bishat Tsa'aro. The same term in the Hebrew, Ein Adam Nitpas. A person is not caught, the Talmud says, for what he does when he is in pain. That's what the Talmud says. You're not responsible for what you do when you're in pain. And that's highlighting the injustice of the story. Just like it's not just to punish somebody for what they do when they're in pain, so too it's not just to punish somebody when this is his money he's trying to take. So the Agnon is just highlighting the injustice of the story by referring to this Talmudic line. Okay. Going back into the story, I don't want to spend a lot of time on that quote, I just wanted to note it for you. So, we're on the fifth line, on page 196. But the presumption in that jurisdiction was that the more one spoke the truth, the more was he deemed to be lying. The judge called the witnesses. The priest came forward, each one in turn taking out his cross from under his vestments and kissing it and testifying that on said day of said month at said hour, they were about to open said box when they found a Jew with a stone in his hand about to smash the box. I see your hand, Ian. Hang in there. The judge then asked the witnesses, do you recognize this old man as the one who was about to smash the box? And they repeated after him, we testify on our oath against this old man that he was about to smash the box. The man was taken aback that men of such high order should take the oath where it is not required. He said, I'm not arguing with you. I was. He shook his hands and his chains rattled, making a loud noise. The judge turned to him and said, are you inferring with your protest that these high-ranking witnesses have perjured against you? God forbid. It had never occurred to the old man to say so. It was true he was about to open the box. What did this judge see to indicate he was lying? But he would not lie. All he wanted was his money back. He was chained hand and foot with chains of iron, and he was incriminated out of his own mouth. Yes, Ian.
Why didn't he go to a place where he wouldn't be seen, as well as realize that by being seen, people will have different opinions?
Yeah. And the answer is, going back to what Agnon said earlier, he's a simple man. He doesn't get it. He doesn't understand. He thinks this is a safe place to put his money. It's out there by the road. It's being held in this statue. Nobody else is ever there. There are cobwebs on it. I don't even know why the priests came to take out the money. I don't know if they came regularly or just happened to be that they came by on this day and they caught him. Unclear in the story. Yes, Rosalind.
So, but Agnon is setting up attention. I mean, the money obviously belongs to the man, and he's simple and he doesn't realize that it's a Christian charity box. But he is putting it in a place that he shouldn't be putting it in. So if they let him speak, perhaps he could exonerate himself. But he's obviously, Agnon is a talented craftsperson, and he's a craftsman, and he's setting up this tension.
Yeah, it's injustice. I mean, that's a theme in this story.
It's unjust, but it's unjust, but it's they're so appalled that he has put it in a holy Christian place. I mean, I think charity boxes in Christianity are quite sacred. And mm-hmm. He has, in their eyes, desecrated it.
Oh, yeah. No, for sure. Part of this really is something he did to himself. And that's going to come up when we talk about the themes of the story, for sure. Claudette, and then Rose, and then Vanessa.
I think he is saying there's a danger in being a simple person. Because, you know, putting your trust in this society, that's the danger.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely true. We're going to come back to that. Rose.
That this, the simplicity is one thing, but I think that it's also the theme of racism and hatred against the Jews. And it's so prevalent here, because here's a poor, ignorant man who knew nothing, and the quote-unquote priest probably knew what was going on, and it was complete hatred of the Jews. There's that as well in the theme, that there's racist elements.
So I don't know that the priests are aware. I don't know that the priests are aware.
And that he's a Jew.
They're aware he's a Jew. But I don't know that the priests are aware that this is his money. How would they be?
Oh, I see. So, because...
You know?
But the fact that the judge didn't allow him to even tell his story.
Right.
Shows, like, what kind of judge is this?
So we're going to come back to... Again, we're going to come back to Jewish-Christian relations in this story. We're not there yet. I want to go through the whole story. But yes, we're absolutely coming back to that. Vanessa and then Susan.
Judge a Roman?
A Catholic.
Oh, he's a
Catholic.
Because if he was Roman, I didn't understand.
No, Roman there. Right, no. Rome is Agnon's way of saying. When it says they came from Rome, he means they came from the Roman Catholic Church. But keep in mind, because it's important, what you're picking up on is valuable. To Agnon, everything traces to the destruction of the Second Temple. Right, I mentioned to you last week Agnon's Nobel speech, where he says, as a result of the destruction of the temple by the Romans, I ended up being born in the Ukraine. I absolutely believe that that's an intentional way of referring to the church. I think so. Okay, so let's see what's going on here. If you take a look, we're now at the bottom of page 196. We're about 12 lines up from the bottom. But he was still well served by his eyes. He's chained hand and foot, we said. He's incriminated by his mouth, but his eyes still work, which he raised and looked into the judges' and witnesses' faces. A weird state of affairs. All speak the truth, and the truth gives rise to a miscarriage of justice. With one eye on his chains, the old man looked with his other eye about their heads. He saw the image of that man hanging on the courtroom wall. It's a Christian court. And said to himself, "You smile at me." He began rapping on the table with both hands until the sound of his chains was heard from one end of the building to the other, which is another allusion, but I'm not going into that one. There's so much here going on in the story. And he cried out, "Leave me alone and give me back my money." But they beat him and put him back in jail. The old man sat on the straw and complained, "Oh God, it was plain for you to see how many years I have had to contend with this exile. I ate no good food, I wore no fine clothes, and I occupied no fine lodgings. All my years were sour to me as vinegar." If you wanted something explicit, Agnon has now given you something explicit. "And I accepted it all lovingly, solely because I was to go up to your holy land." Now it's a religious statement. "And now that my time has come to go up, my captors have come and taken my money and put me in jail." So he sat and cried until he dozed off in the midst of his crying. At midnight, he woke of his own accord. In the room of the jail, there was no mezuzah and no can. He began shaking his chains and chanting in a sad voice some songs and praises which he was used to singing at night. And so he went on chanting until he fell asleep again. Parenthetically, the midnight here, does it remind you of anything? I mean, midnight's been throughout the story, but midnight for the Jew, if you think of the song from the Seder, is the time of Ge'ulah, it's the time of redemption, right? The song at the end of the Seder, it was at Chatzi HaLaila, the middle of the night. All these things that happened biblically in the middle of the night. So here, he wakes up at midnight, he's shaking his chains, he's chanting until he falls asleep. And now we get the surreal moment. The jail door opened, and there appeared some apparition of a man with a stone box in his hand and a certain smile on his lips. And when he says, an old man with the box, he means, as Agnon has been calling him, that man, Yeshu. The old man turned his eyes away from him and tried to fall asleep. That man, put him on his feet and said, hold on to me, and I will bring you to wherever you wish to go. The old man extended his arms toward that man and said, how shall I hold on to you when my hands are in chains of iron? They really ought to have italicized that man the way that they do elsewhere in the translation. And the latter replied, regardless thereof, you shall. The old man opened wide the palms of his hand and clasped them around the neck of that man, who smiled and said, I shall promptly bring you to the land of Israel. The old man embraced the neck of that man as the latter turned and faced in the direction of Jerusalem. On their first flight, that man stopped smiling. On their second flight, the old man's fingers turned cold. On their third flight, he felt that he was embracing cold stone. His heart melted, his hands waxed weak. He was set loose and fell to the ground. On the morrow, when his captors came in, he was not to be found. That night, a knocking was heard on the door of the Kollel in Jerusalem. Kollel being where people study, but they're also responsible for burial. Those who went outdoors saw a flight of angels, which had come from the exile bearing a mortal form, which that very night they took and buried, in keeping with the custom in Jerusalem, not to hold over the dead, meaning they bury even at night. They don't make them wait until the next day. How wild is that ending, huh? It's like, I didn't see that coming. So, a couple of things here. In this ending. First of all, as I said before, when he makes Aliyah, when he finally determines to go, it involves a reunion with God. Just like the mystic pose that he took, he's now looking to be with God. And you notice where he was facing? Turned and faced in the direction of Jerusalem. If you take a look at source number, I didn't bring it on the sheet, sorry, but probably because I just expected people may be aware, we pray towards Jerusalem. This is a prayer. And he's brought to Israel by angels. There are various places in rabbinic literature where the righteous are escorted by celestial beings on their way to the grave. One other note, I mentioned last week that Agnon is sort of trolling or pranking with Christianity. Did you notice how many journeys, right? Three journeys. I thought that was fascinating because of source number 11. In source number 11, the Talmud tells us about how different angels travel. The angel Michael, who is an angel that is supposed to be protective of the Jewish people, is able to make his journey in one flight. He can get where he needs to go, one trip. Gabriel, who is a punishing angel, takes two flights. Elijah, whose origins are human, needs four. The angel of death, eight. He needs eight flights to get where he's going. But during a plague, he can do it in one. Now, what this passage is talking about is a really good question and way beyond the scope of where we are. But no one takes three. Right? We got one, two, four, eight, exponential, not three, because Agnon is pranking you, and he's saying, hey, this one isn't on the list. He's not the Jewish one. He's the Christian one, and for him, it's three flights. That's what he's doing. Yes, Claudette.
And he's saying that at the end of it all,
wasn't that one, this that man that finished it because it turned into stone.
Mm. That's an interesting idea for sure. So there are so many layers to this story. Oh, Susan, sorry.
Interesting.
Like we talked about it being like Joe Buscett, but
yes.
Joe had a good end.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't make up for what he lost. But Joe's ending, remember when we talked about it after he,
right.
God spoke to him and he accepted everything God said.
Right.
And his whole life turned around for the positive. He got better, he had children, he made wealth again.
Right. So I'm coming back to Job. But I will note for you that in Job chapter 42, sentence 10, it sounds like he even got back what he lost. He actually had not a new set of, you know, of family members, but actually the same ones. Yeah. So I want to talk about the layers of the story. We only have 4 minutes left. So the old man, first of all, is anonymous in this story. We never get his name. We don't know the name of his town. And in truth, you can see him having many identities, which we have to explore. Some of them you've pointed out already. The simple Jew, who makes up what he lacks in ritual and Jewish knowledge with his loving commitment to Israel. You have the ardent Zionist. His sole joy in life comes from his dream of making it to Israel. You have the unintentional worshiper of, or devotee of, the Christian Savior. Right? He's saved from prison by an image of that man. He's the victim of a justice system that is directed, as was noted before, by prejudice and doesn't pursue truth. No one is letting him actually tell the story. And he's a penitent. He's a Baal Tshuva. He repents. He comes to God in the course of his pursuit of Aliyah. But what I wanted to make sure to say today, and tomorrow, and then next week I want to go through some of these themes more, but the common theme in all of them is, as someone indicated earlier, that the old man really is a Job. He suffers terribly, he remains loyal to his vision, and the readers are meant to learn from his experience. He loses his wife, he loses his children, he loses his wealth. In truth, Job doesn't lose his wife, but his wife turns on him. She tells him he should curse God and die, which is not good advice. But in general, he loses the family, he loses the wealth. The vinegar theme is clearly meant to show the sourness of his life. And he takes more wine and makes it into vinegar every day. But take a look. This is one of those things where you read a translation and you can miss something. The Hebrew for can is ketone in this story. Ketone is an unusual word. It's not Hebrew. It sounds to me like it may originally be Greek, although I'm not sure of that. It's not a standard word. You do find it in the Talmud in a source that Agnon was without doubt very aware of. Take a look at source number 12. It's a Mishnah in Sukkah. We have a chag, a holiday, called Sukkot, where we sit outdoors in the Sukkah. What are you supposed to do if it rains? What do? You go indoors, right? That's what you're supposed to do. You go indoors. So if you take a look at source number 12, the Mishnah says, when rain descends, at what point may one leave? At what point do you leave the sukkah? When food is ruined. And they compared this experience of having to leave the sukkah. What is this like? A slave who comes to dilute his master's cup. In Talmudic times, they would drink wine diluted. They didn't drink it straight. You would add a certain ratio of water to wine. So the slave, the servant here is doing the right thing. He's coming to dilute his master's cup. He brings him a ketone of water. And the master pours his pitcher, the ketone, before him, literally on his face. You follow that? The ketone is what the servant wants to use to serve the master, and the master rejects it. In Agnon's story, this man who wants to make Aliyah uses his ketone. He uses this can, as it's translated, to try to serve God, and it is rejected by God. It breaks open in his face, so to speak, and now it becomes his downfall. He's very much a Job. Job says, "I was loyal to you, God. I did everything you wanted me to do, and then you've done this to me. I want you to talk to me, he says. And like Job, he remains loyal to his ideals despite his suffering, and even despite the exhaustion and the suffering that those ideals bring upon him. Right? There are a lot of ways to read what Job does in his book. I see it's 11. If people have to go, they can go, but I want another minute, and then I'll take questions. The point is that despite the exhaustion of this man, despite his suffering, he stays with it, and Job, in his book, appears to stay with it as well. And in the end, he reaches his goal. Job reaches his. He gets God to communicate to him somehow. And here, he gets his goal of going to Israel. It sounds like a very unhappy ending, but on the other hand, he got what he longed for. I don't know what he would do after that. What he wanted was to be buried in Israel. But this entire experience of suffering is meant to teach the reader a lesson. The lesson we learn here is less about the old man and more about the events that befall him, right? Unlike with Job, like the lessons about Zionism that we're going to see. But this is really I think the Job vision is spot on. I think you have to read this as a story of a modern Job wanting to get to Israel. So what we're going to do, I'm going to take questions, but what I want to do next week is go through some more layers in this story. I want to talk about the satire of human justice. I want to talk about the role of the simple Jew. And I definitely want to talk about this in terms of the Jewish search for Christian support. And of course, Zionism, the Balfour Declaration, Jewish reliance on the Christian world, all that and more. And God willing, I will be done with COVID and it'll be an easier experience. But thank you for taking me through this hour. I feel a lot better than I did an hour ago, so I really appreciate it.
Good. Stay well.
Feel much better.
Thank you.
Feel better.
Thank you. Thank you. God willing, I will.
Thank you.
Thank you. Does anyone have questions, though, on the story? I didn't want to cut off people's questions. Yeah.
So we're back on page 197. Well, that's the last page. And it says, at midnight he woke on his own accord. In the room of the jail there was no mezuzah and no can. So
yes.
What's the can? Is this the vinegar can? Or
yes. Yes. It's the vinegar can.
The can has been versed.
Yes.
Remember versed.
Yep. So they're contrasting for us his experience in the jail with his experience before. He always rose at midnight, but now he doesn't have what he had before. Number one, he has no can. And number two, no mezuzah. Remember, the mezuzah represents God's presence.
Right. So the mezuzah, to my mind, is more devastating than the can. I mean, he is not only alone physically and in chains, but, you know, even all the vestiges of Jewish life are gone.
So I'm not sure how he feels. I think to the reader it may be true that losing the mezuzah is more important. And maybe for the man at this stage it's more important. Now that he has come back to God, maybe now it matters to him. I think earlier in the story it wouldn't have fazed him. I think now maybe it does.
No, right now. Because as we said, he's making a religious statement now. That the story has turned.
Yeah.
He is no longer just a man on the loose trying to get to Israel. He has become much more involved in his faith.
Yes, I would agree.
We talked about that.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. Yeah, absolutely. Linda and then Rose.
Sorry. I just want to ask you if you could comment on the reactions of the villagers to when he went to break the box.
Right.
When he was captured.
So I think the villagers, it's highlighting the Jewish fear of persecution. Like, we called it in the Hebrew, Chilul Hashem, desecration of God's name. You've given the Christians an excuse to attack us. You know, that's what I see, is that fear of their neighbors, which unfortunately, we know too well, Eastern Europe, usually Agnon stories are about Eastern Europe in the 18th, 19th century, stories of this variety. And that's a period when that's all you need is a Jew to commit a crime like this, and for sure pogroms are coming. You know, that's what I would see. Okay, Rose.
And, ramp on him.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I just want to say that the loss of the mezuzah, you know, he's got that image of the trilogy of Christ, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Just before that, he talks about the loss of the mezuzah. So I would link the two together. I mean, mm-hmm. It's kind of a tragedy, but.
Yeah, no, I definitely hear that. I do hear that. It's Judaism is being submerged and Christian imagery is everywhere. I agree with that. Claudette. You're muted.
What was the Christian society reaction to Adnan's story when it came out?
That's a really good question. I don't know. I shouldn't say that. I do know. Sorry. Took me a second.
I thought it was in Hebrew. They don't read it.
Not necessarily, no. Yeah. But in terms of answering your question, I mentioned when we started the class last week that the reason why I felt comfortable sharing the published translation of this story, normally I would not share that because it's for sale, but a major reason why I was comfortable sharing it was because it's available on lots of websites. Most of the websites where you can find this are Christian websites. They took this as demonstrating Agnon's embrace of Christianity. That man is bringing the Jew to Israel. Credit Christianity for the Jewish return to the land.
I can see that.
Totally. And I think we said last week, I think I brought you a letter that was sent to him, I think it was recorded by Professor Orela Abramson, in which they said to him, what have you done? Please retract this story. Because the Jews read it and thought this is, you know, an embrace of Christianity. It was frightening for the Jews. Okay. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Rabbi.
Be well.
You too. Everybody should be well.